Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of the Royal Blue Podcast. Today we have a familiar voice, a familiar face as well around Goodison, but here in a slightly different guise, Gavin Buckland is the man at the centre of the table, centre of discussion with myself and Dave Prentice, because we are here to talk about his book, Money Can't Buy Us Love, Everton in the 1960s. And so myself and Preno, for the next half an hour or so, we'll pick Gav's brains and ask him everything we want to know and need to know about this book, yeah, including where we can buy it and how much it costs, Gav, of course.
Right, okay. That's the important bit. Yeah.
I think, first of all, Gav, why did you want to write about this particular subject and the characters involved?
Well, the first thing, I think, and Psano will confirm this, considering our club is, you know, if you know your history, we must be historically the most unrecorded major football league club in terms of books on the club. There's books on biographies and autobiographies and sort of books with players and interviews, but in the terms of a history going from point A to point B, just isn't anything, you know. So that was the first thing. That was the first sort of criteria. And the second one is start off in the 60s, because it was our most successful decade. It was a diverse decade for Everton in terms of what I tried to bring out in the book. It was a lot of good, great stuff, but a lot of bad stuff as well. We've done there which have shone a light on. And it took place, obviously, the whole Mersey millionaire thing, in a time of great cultural, economic and political change. The 1960s was probably, you know, the pivotal decade of the 20th century. And it's no coincidence that I say in the back that I think the Guardian said 1963 was the first year of the modern world.
Right.
And there's no coincidence that, you know, nice coincidence that we won the title in a way that had not really been won before in 1963. And that's what I've tried to do in the book, is weave all them cultural, economic, Liverpool being the centre of that, of course, in terms of cultural terms, and football and threads together, you know, because it's not just about Everton, it's the environment in which the club was operating at the time.
To be honest, I thought I knew about Everton in the 60s because, you know, I've read whatever's out there about Everton in that decade. Contrary to popular opinion, I wasn't around then, you know, so I didn't remember it. My first game was 1975, but I'd heard a lot about the School of Science, Ball, Harvey Kendall, you know, the famous come from behind FA Cup victory in 66, which I've watched, whatever's out there on YouTube, the very, very limited, you know, sort of clips of Alex Young. And I thought I knew about this wonderfully classy, artistic football team that, you know, was underestimated and underrated, really, throughout that decade. Everyone talks about Man United and Best, Law and Charlton. Everyone talks about the great Spurs push and run side. Not many talk about Everton. So I found this in education. Great book, by the way. I've got two on the go at the moment. A Jack Reacher one, which, God, I'm absolutely grinding through. It's slow as anything. Never go back. Don't bother buying that. buy this instead. I flew through this. Absolutely loved it. But it educated me. I mean, as the title suggests, Money Can't Buy Us Love. Everton were not a popular football team in the 60s for many reasons, apart from, you know, being Mersey millionaires and trying to buy success, which is what the London press was saying. The football fans at the time were, shall we say, unpleasant, wrecking trains, causing fights, throwing darts at Tottenham goalkeepers, allegedly. I mean, you know, Gav explores that.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a myth or whether it actually happened or not, I don't know. But as a result, those semicircles were introduced behind the goals. And it just gave me a completely different insight into the way that Everton were perceived throughout that decade, which I really enjoyed, you know, in a perverse kind of way.
Yeah, I echo, pardon the pun, Prano's comments there, that likewise, I thought I knew a lot, but it's when you get into the detail. And I think some of the other things is, because it's now 50, 60 years ago, is there's a lot of narratives that have been built up over the years that when you actually do a check and balance about them, They just went through. Yeah. Or like, you know, certain people did this. No, they didn't. Certain people
said without giving away too much of what's in the book, is the one you can give an example?
I'd say the general, say, impression of, say, Alex Young relationship with Harry Katter was that Alex, and Harry obviously long gone, and Alex sadly passed away a year or two back, was that Alex was hard done by Harry, and there's stories about him not giving £100,000 that he was due and all this type of thing, and that Harry did everything to, keep Young out the side. But when you have a look at the facts, actually that wasn't the case at all. For example, Alex said that Harry stopped him going to play in America once he'd finished at Everton. And actually that wasn't true. Alex phoned the boss of the New York Generals, I think they were called, and said, no, I can't come over because I'm homesick. Which, bear in mind, Alex had refused to move to Sheffield because he was homesick. It makes a lot of sense, And Everton, for example, took a 10 grand hit on Alex Young's transfer to get him out of Everton so he could get £2,000 off Glenn Torren as part of the deal with that. So they're actually losing £10,000 to benefit Alex. Where Alex over the years has said he was hard done by the club and hard done by Katrick, and that's just not true. There was bare flashpoints, I think. And I think when Alex left, only Brian LeBone had played more times for Everton under Katrick than him, and I say in the book, Dave, as you know, Harry changed the formation of the team twice to keep Alex in the team. Moving from the old Scout WM in the early 60s to 4-2-4 so we could play Alex the centre forwards role with Fred Pickering, and then change to 4-3-3 to play Alex in a deeper role. So there was an element of truth in what Alex was saying, but when you have a look at the facts over the period of years, the general message that he gave out just wasn't true at all. Harry and the club went out of the way on occasions for him.
There are a couple of things in there that I'm not going to give too much away. I mean, the identity of the manager that John Moores wanted as Everton boss prior to Harry Katterick raised my eyebrows, and you'll need to buy the book to discover that. But the one I am going to give away, because it's just such a great story, how close Everton came to buying Ferenc Puskás. I think, wow, how did that happen? And it did. It was very, very close, and the Football League basically barred it in the end, didn't they? And John Moores was furious.
Yeah, and on two occasions, late 50s and the mid-60s.
How old would Puskás have been at the time?
He would have been near his peak at the late 50s. Wow. But getting on, sort of just over his peak. And Moores said we tried to get him again in the mid-60s when his peak had gone. He's still playing for Real Madrid, but, we could still do a job. And there's one of the things about, and one of the fascinating things about the book, which, when you do things like this, in retrospect, I think I should have done more on this, or I overplayed that, is Evan's relationship with the Football League, and Moores in particular, the way in the Football League, and how they were very much like, you see Man City's battles with UEFA over certain things and rules and regulations and where you can get players from and how players are paid and stuff. It's been all, and Evan Moore's relationship with the Football League in the early 60s was like that. That they'd never had to deal that genteel world of football and the car dealer, chairman. They'd never had to deal with someone with so much power and influence, who had a lot of powerful people working for him. And I think consequently, Moore's stopped a few things happening in football because suited Evan. And he was frustrated over the way the authorities could not allow, foreign players to come into the club. He was moaning about, Real Madrid being backed by the Spanish government and all this. With some of the stuff that's still being mentioned to this day, and Moores was onto that in the late 50s, early 60s.
I think he upset the apple cart in that respect because he'd come from a more corporate, if you like, background.
Absolutely, and
perceived and looked at the way of running football clubs differently to how the Football League had previously dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Football League was very antiquated. He was particularly frustrated over the fact that every club in the top two divisions had a vote and the bottom two divisions had a smaller number of votes. So to get change never happened because all the smaller clubs would gang up.
Yes.
On the bigger clubs, and he said that wasn't good enough. You had to have an elite. You had to have a group of super clubs at the top, of which he obviously wanted Everton. And so he was frustrated that you could never change things because of the voting structure within the Football League. Plus, he found the Home Office rules on immigration regarding footballers and Football League rules as well. He just thought that they just stifled sort of development of English football. I suspect that led to our poor European record in the 60s because I felt that they always fight with two hands behind the back. Mm. And I felt that they didn't commit themselves to European football because they played Inter Milan very early on in the early 60s. Who had like Luis Suarez, the original Luis Suarez. He cost like £210,000. And our most expensive signing was like Tony Kay, it was 55,000, you know. So you had all these expensive imports that they were allowed to bring in.
And we also spent lots of money on referees.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I talk about that as well, yeah. And our rules didn't allow for that type of thing. And he felt they were fighting with their hands tied behind the back.
Right.
And I suspect that sort of psyche crept into the club the way it regarded European football. Harry was distrustful of it. He just felt two legs was not real football. Football games over 90 minutes. And he'd say that the likes of Inter Milan and Benfica couldn't survive in the Football League, which was rubbish, yeah. With all due respect. Of course they could. That was where some of Moyes' beliefs, I think he was right on a couple of them. I think they damaged the club a little bit. I think one of the undercurrents in the book is that desire for success in the end became quite counterproductive and, you know, dangerous, I think. And even in the late 70s, people were saying that. I mentioned Colin Malham said in the Sunday Telegraph in 1977, they pointed Billy Bingham after Moyes had sacked him, that Everton's sort of obsession with success has been long-term, has had a damaging effect on the club, and he was right.
Do you think that, so coming back to that theme of the Mersey millionaires, and just to paraphrase a bit, you said that John Moyes had obviously helped Everton to spending money with such naked short-term ambition and ruthlessness that it ultimately sent like shockwaves to English football.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the way that we operated and John Moyes took us into a new kind of sphere of thinking and opportunity, did Everton in that era set a precedent for what has been to come fairly recently with Chelsea and Abramovich and Man City, etc.? Was that the first time really?
Absolutely, absolutely. I say they created the template for the modern football club, not just the modern big club, but the all clubs within the Football League, where there's just a desire for success, whether in the top level or in Division Two, which is why some Football League clubs in lower divisions have got themselves into financial trouble. It was shockwaves because the way Moyes was challenging the authorities, but it was the public ambition of the owner, which had never been seen before. There'd been clubs with money before, but it was that public ambition and that ruthlessness of the owner that had not really been seen in English football before. I'd say a quote from him in his opening press conference to Harry Kattrick, where one of the members of the press said, "You've just sacked Johnny Carey after finishing fourth. What would you do to Harry Kattrick if he finishes fourth?" And Moyes says, "Well, I'll sack him as well, you know." And that type of thing had just never been seen before in English football, A, from a chairman and just generally from a football club. You know, Prano can remember the days, I know, not the 60s, just... But, managers could stay manager club for years without really doing anything. You know, the odd cup run, but say mid-table, and just staying jobs. Yeah, totally. There was no real challenge from chairman and owners to be successful.
But surely there was, of that era as there is now, was there not demand from the stands and the terraces, though? Or was it not as vociferous as it might be now? Or is it a case of modern-day football fans have a platform that fans of that era did not?
I think this is a chicken egg thing. I'm convinced that, you know, Dave alluded before to like the bad behaviour of Everton fans, and people put that link together, that demand for success on the pitch. I mean, we were quite a tough team in 62-63, they could play, but that demand for success led to a certain amount of ruthlessness on the pitch,
right,
which bred sort of anxiety, frustration on the terraces, you know, impatience perhaps on the terraces, and that manifested itself in hooliganism.
And we had a rising force across the park as well, but they suddenly became rivals, and they'd been in second division for 10 years. And
absolutely.
Hadn't been an issue.
And that was the irony is Liverpool fans could be as dangerous as Everton supporters, especially in away games, but it was that feel-good factor of the cop that was sort of broadcast nationally, put a sort of protective blanket over their behaviour.
Right.
Even though their behaviour was on occasions matched Everton fans because they came from the same city. They were the same group of people, so they're going to behave in the same way. And talk about the social aspect of Merseyside and its effect on crowd behaviour in the 60s. And so Liverpool fans are always going to behave in the same way as Everton supporters, but they never got the same coverage. We were banned up by the trains, makes front page news in the Daily Express. Liverpool bans on the trains, doesn't get any news at all, you know. So yeah, so we created this reputation around ourselves as a club, and that stuck, unfortunately. Some of it is still there, not on the negative side of it, but it bred a certain amount of, I think, paranoia. I think distrust of authorities and sort of being a very close-knit club.
Was there a resentment then in that respect, or
of people of us,
of the authorities from us?
In more certainly, right. yeah, absolutely.
And that would feed into the terraces.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. I'm sure of that. But it was the effect on us. It became quite isolated, I think. And there are those who say that we are still a little bit like that to this day. And it certainly meant that we never got our dues as well by some of the stuff we played in the 60s.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that, you know, so the most depressing aspect of the whole, you know, sort of decade for me was that having gone through the first half of the decade, winning trophies and being a successful team, but not really getting praise for it because the London press especially resented the fact that Everton were too ruthless, they were too physical. It was like win-at-all-cost mentality. When that evolved and Harry Kattar created his second side, which was like so easy on the eye, so great to watch, and played, you know, football from the gods, if you like, between 1967 and 1970, that finally culminated in winning the league with 66 points, which was only one shy of the record at the time. Absolutely sensational win. And it was overshadowed. I mean, everybody seemed to focus on Leeds' unfortunate demise because they were going for everything and fell at, you know, the final hurdle in everything. And we had the Mexico World Cup looming as well. And so, this great title triumph that should have been the crowning glory of Kattrick's career was largely overshadowed.
A question for you both of you on then. Is that because Kattrick is you know, somebody obviously not of the era, but somebody whose perception of Kattrick was he was not a media man. He wasn't a media darling by any stretch of the imagination. Do you think that played a part in that?
Yeah, I think definitely. He wasn't voted manager of the year by the press, which normally went to the title winner manager or the European Cup winner manager. You know, went to Don Revie, he didn't win anything. And had he won it in great style, as you say, playing great football. Even Brian Clough said it was great football, you know, so you must be doing something right. Yeah, I think that was definitely the case. Harry's, and this ultimately sort of led to his downfall, I think. Harry's attitude and sort of distrust of the press was great when you were playing winning football and finishing as champions and appearing in cup finals. When things went on the slide after 70, because the book does go up to 73 when he was sacked, that went against him.
Right.
You know, that he had no friends in the press, so people were quite happy to stick the knife into him, you know. And I think, undoubtedly, the club's attitude, not just Harry, but, you know, they said that they liked television. They quite happy to be on television. I'm not sure whether that was the case. They just and they won the title. You know, they should have won the title against West Brom in 70 on Match of the Day, Saturday afternoon, in front of 10 million viewers on, you know, on sort of glorious technicolor on BBC One. And it was a freezing cold Wednesday night, 1st of April, because the season finished early as well. Because as Pano said, everything was overshadowed by the Mexico World Cup. And what we got, a couple of grainy news film of, which is in black and white.
Nothing exists anymore. There's nothing. There's like a 12-second clip exists on YouTube of the post-match celebrations, and that's it.
And everything over them was overshadowed by Leeds' quest for the treble, because the same night they played Celtic, didn't they, in the Battle of Britain, you know, European Cup semi-final, and Everton winning the title was just a sideshow, and that was just typical of sometimes fate worked against them. But I think the club almost certainly and their attitude towards the press, which didn't just come from Harry, came from other people within the club, went against them in terms of the way they were covered when they were successful.
Because there's a nice line in the book, Gav, where and I'll paraphrase, where John Moores had said that, you know, the club, we want the best players, the best coaches, the best trainers, the best directors. So was Kattrick at the time, was he the best trainer out there? Was he to Abramovich, was he Mourinho?
Not necessarily Moores' first choice. It was interesting, not only did Moores offer the job to somebody else, he offered it for £5,000. Mm. And Harry was quite happy to get £3,500. So that shows how desperate Moores was to get the other person in. Yeah, there is obvious parallels with Chelsea, which we talk about in Chelsea 2003-04, where you've got Johnny Carey, who was the gentleman manager, good, but not good enough, and that's Claudio Ranieri. Yeah. New owner comes in, gives their incumbent manager a year in charge to see if they're any good. They do really well finishing the top four, both of them, but then decide they need to bring somebody in who's a bit more ruthless and a bit in my, reflects my personality. So there's obviously, you know, a close parallel with what went on with Chelsea in 2003-04. And like Chelsea, you inherited a really good team as well, with really good players. I mean, some of the players, you know, like Drogba was signed by Ranieri, I think, wasn't he? There was lots of similarities between Carrick and Mourinho. Not only the way they took over the clubs, but personality-wise as well. Both can be... There's a quote there, I think, from Alan Hardaker, who Plano remembered was the chairman of the Football League, who was the one of the major blockers, I think, to Everton. And he said that a manager should be... I can't remember the exact quote, but, you know, perfect manager's ruthless. And
I think every ruthless leader needs a hatchet man.
Yeah. And Hardacre was saying that, and he said every manager should be ruthless and, you know, distrustful of the press and stuff like this, which fits Mourinho and Carrick perfectly.
Yeah.
And so lots of different, you know, things that I like between Carrick and Mourinho, as indeed I say in the book, Carrick and Bob Paisley as well. They talk about the difference between Carrick and Shankly, but Carrick and Paisley had a lot of similarities the way they built the teams.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
In terms of, just to give maybe younger listeners a kind of reference point, John Moores came in this period and was splashing the cash, so to speak. What sort of figures were we spending on players, and comparably, what are we talking about now?
That's a good question. I mean, they were loans. He never sort of sugar daddy type thing, because he was business. You know, businessmen don't give the money away, do they? You don't need just to buy. If you'd went out and bought, they bought Fred Pickering, say Alan Ball, say in the mid-60s, do a British record. Transfer fees, you know, for Alan Ball in particular. So you're talking whatever the British record transfer fee is, that's what it was,
right.
You know,
yeah.
You know, it's like going out and paying 60, 70 million pounds on a midfielder.
There was no financial fair play, you could spend whatever you wanted.
So if you think of Alan Ball, man of the match in the World Cup final, 21's peak years ahead of him. If he was playing for England now, how much would he be worth in the transfer market?
Yeah.
And we went out and bought him. You know, and not for 110,000. 110,000 is not like 70 million now. But in terms of relationship to other transfer fees at the time,
in the scale of the market.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could imagine, it is very similar to, you know, maybe young fans remember when I say Mourinho came and you were buying players every week for big money. That's what Harry did for a year, I think, maybe at Everton. It massive, massive fees that we paid, you know, and not really being seen, you know, done before, I think, to that level. Other clubs like Spurs have bought big, as Bruno said.
I love the little anecdotes in there as well about the players that we nearly signed.
There's
so many in there which are incredible. Joe Baker's the one that comes out over and over again. But, you know, there were other... Was Dennis Law?
They looked at Dennis Law. I don't think Harry got slagged off a little bit by the sports for not signing Dennis Law. The one that I was absolutely gutted about was they could have bought Jimmy Green off in 1970, who was with Howard, probably the best uncapped player for England. And Jimmy would have played perfectly off Joe Royal as a sort of like second striker. And showed how his sort of powers were waning. 10 years before, Harry's intelligence would have, and radar would have known he was for sale and bought him. But he was 24 hours behind Stoke City.
Right.
And Greenoff had already done the deal with Stoke. And Harry, not to be accused of sort of tapping anybody up, sent Alan Ball to... try and persuade them to sign for Everton. And Jimmy, to his credit, has already agreed terms with Stoke. And he was a player in the early 70s who would have suited Everton perfectly. He would have done, and he was a great forward for 10 years.
But
you know?
Then he would never have signed for Man United and would never have scored that goal at Liverpool in the FA Cup semi final. So there is a silver lining.
All the final, yeah. But at the same time, he could have done it for Everton, though, could he?
And that was a Goodison as well, that FA Cup semi final winner.
Yeah, so. so the added, you know, when you read play, oh no, we should, why didn't we sign him? You know, we could have signed Ron Davis, another one, great centre forward. Yeah. A couple of times Harry was in for him. Franny Lee, even centre for Franny Lee, he bought Ernie Hunt. You know, but all managers are like that. But what Harry did up until he bought Howard, he always bought the right players. So he was missing out on players. It didn't really matter because he always bought the right players, bought Kendall. It was after 67, that's where his magic in the transfer market started to go. He was buying the wrong players and missing out or refusing to buy players who would have taken the club forward. I say in the book, Martin Buchan played for Man United. We desperately needed a driving force at the back, like we had, because Labby had, you know, retired. Needed that type of leader at the back, at centre-half. And Harry said, I'm not interested. I'm only interested in midfield players, which is a ludicrous position to be.
As a manager, did he work better with funds or with next to nothing?
Both.
Okay.
Both. At Sheffield Wednesday, and this is a thing as Harry as a manager, not just as Everton, is Harry is compared with his great managerial peers, you know, Bill Shankly, Matt Busby, Bill Nicholson, Dom Revy, who all had success at those clubs, you know, Man United, Spurs, Liverpool, Leeds, and developed great teams, but within the one club, in the same environment. Harry's management was different to theirs, and this is completely lost now because people only view his record at Everton against those four other managerial greats. When what you should do in the round is view his managerial record at Sheffield Wednesday and Everton, where he took over Sheffield Wednesday in 58. Had no money. He bought two players, I think, for £15,000 each. And got them within 2 years, second place in the league, FA Cup semi-final. I think he still regarded as being Sheffield Wednesday's greatest manager. And he did that with no money. And then he went from there, and those pressures, to going to Everton, where you've got loads of money, but you've got the pressure of the need for success. And so it was that success in two different environments, of having no money and lots of money, that actually make him, you know, people miss that comparison.
Quite unique in that respect.
It's unique. And I say in the book that, to me, his peak years as a manager is probably 58 to probably the mid-60s. Mm. I think by the end of the 60s, I think he'd become a little bit blasé. He had a real vision and hunger in the early 60s, which I think had disappeared a little bit by the end of the decade. And I tell the story about J.L. Manning, who was a columnist in the Daily Mail, said in 64, they bought Fred Pickering, said clubs shouldn't be allowed to buy players during the season.
Going back to the modern day.
Because then if they can do that, we'll show, but managers like Harry Carter will show how they can manage without, you know, money, you know. And Harry did a very terse response. Well, you know, look at my record, the Sheffield Wednesday, when I had no money.
Yeah.
And to be fair, John Mannon, his name was, he reprinted Harry's letter in the Daily Mail for him a week. And then Harry was, to say Harry was a bit browned off about it is an understatement. But he did it with both, and people forget that in two completely different environments. And that was none as other opposition managers did. Mm. You know, okay, maybe not had the opportunity to, but it was a massive achievement to do that across both clubs.
And again, without giving too much away, maybe a question for Preno as well. So, again, for younger listeners who go, well, we were the Mersey millionaires, and my dad or my granddad have told me, but we sold Alan Ball. How can a club with John Moores at its helm and you know, the tag of Mersey millionaires lose a player of Alan Ball, or did they lose because of the business?
I've heard so much about that in the past, and I've read so many stories about how devastated and traumatised Evertonians were. And I thought Gav gave a really, really balanced perspective on this, both sides of the story. And he was a very, very different footballer when Everton sold him to the one that they'd signed. You could argue he reinvented himself at Arsenal and became, you know, sort of more of a holding player, if you like. But it was okay, his record at Arsenal, but it certainly wasn't anything like what it had been at Everton. And you could argue that getting twice the money he got for him, it was a shrewd bit of business, but equally, the impact he was having on that dressing room, you know, arguments with the teammates, having been made captain, and, you know, basically bullying people a lot of the time and throwing little, you know, sort of childish tantrums all the time. The timing possibly was right. And, you know, not many fans around at that time would say that. But, you know, reading it from a dispassionate viewpoint, you know, so 40-odd years hence, you can understand possibly why he did it.
Yeah.
I'm just flicking through the book because, you know, if you pick up a copy, you'll see there's a great picture in here, Gav, isn't there, of a rather staged handshake between Kasrick and Ball, isn't
it? It reminds me of that time about, remember, was it Lee Bowyer and was it Kieran's dad had the fight at Newcastle and he had this shook hands the following Monday.
Yeah, it's a belter, isn't
that.
It?
They don't look, you know, the body language there tells the tale. Yeah, I'm a pen on that. That chapter in the book was, by to me, my favourite part of the book. 8,500 words. I did a lot of research into that, and there's a lot of stories in there which I think kind of I've not really been seen before about some of the stuff that went on behind the scenes. My own view, which I say, is that Harry was right to sell him. He spoke to. It all started with Ball, which I won't go into, but it all starts with an egg between him and Harry in the dressing room. Well, actually, it wasn't Ball shouting at Harry. after the defeat, home defeat to Sheffield United in September, August 71, and it went on from there. And they played at Derby just before Christmas. And here's a bit of a coincidence for you. You know, sorry about this, we didn't realise the baseball ground at Derby, massive impact on the Holy Trinity and Harry. Because that was Ball's last game. It was Harry's last game as manager.
Right.
And Colin Harvey and Howard Kendall both got injuries in the same game there in September 73 that led to them both leaving the club. And after the game at Derby, Michael Charters, one of Preno's esteemed predecessors, said to Harry after the game, said, you know, is Alan Ball shot? And Harry said, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was starting to change. I think because he was captain, he was trying to do everything. It was a bit like, I alluded, like being a bit like Wayne Rooney at Man United, you know, in his last year. He's just going on, if it's not working on one part of the pitch, I'll move to another part of the pitch. Mm. And he was often now playing with Kendall and Harvey rather than playing third up the pitch where he'd done his best work. And there was a great bit of analysis which I talk about, which Brian James did. He used to write for the Mail, write for the Sunday Times, don't you remember it, Prano, where he, very ahead of its time, the dad dated on Alan Ball playing for England in the mid 60s. And he did three or four games where 20 times he was seen per game going into the opposition box. And he did one game against Switzerland in 1971. And there was only two times that he went in the opposition box because he was playing further back. And they're saying like that, you don't want Alan Ball to do that because you've got players who can do that who are better than him for a start. And I think there was that, so there's that tactical thing, his relationship, and the fact that he was burnt out at the age of 20, what was he, 26, 27 then. And I think Harry just said, yeah, I think we need to get rid. What I would say though is, and I talk about this, is I think he got caught off guard, Harry, on the day he sold Alan Ball. It's not entirely certain he wanted to sell him.
Right.
Then. Because that weekend, there was another Everton player who was up for sale for £150,000. And I think Bertie Moves, the Arsenal manager, phoned him up about the other player, not about Alan Ball. And I think Harry got a bit caught off guard. I don't think he intended to sell Alan Ball on that Monday. Mm. He didn't walk into Belfield and say, I'm going to sell him today. I think he just got caught off guard. Because you don't sell your best player 4 days before Christmas, do you? You know, for big money, knowing that supporters want somebody coming in straight away to replace him just to so you can explain the sale better. And then the FA Cup, third round, was always a massive thing, and clubs never sold the best players before the Cup started, you know. So I remain to be convinced that it was a strategy of selling on Ball. I just think he got caught off guard.
Interesting.
And history borne out that actually he had no idea he was going to buy. He tried to buy Mick Shannon within 24 hours from Southampton, but wouldn't sell him. He probably should have sold him the following summer, I think, and sorted like a strategy for players to come in, but he didn't. And I think that was the surprising thing for me, to never realise until I did the book that actually I'm not sure whether he wanted to sell him on that day. You know, but he should have sold him. Yeah. And I explain why. But it's a fascinating story that because they were both complex characters. Harry was a complex character. Alan was a complex character. I think there was a little bit of, for modern day, you know, you say about Roy Keane being an extension of Alex Ferguson on the pitch because they were quite alike in some respects. But then off the pitch, they were at each other's throats. Yes. I think there was certainly in the last 2 years at Goodison, there was a little bit of that with Alan and Harry. I think Harry wants him as captain, as an extension of him on the pitch. But ultimately, because I think they are very alike in some respects, and Alan said that of his managers that he played under, Harry was the one that was most like him. Like Keane and Ferguson, off the pitch, there was friction between them. And it's a fascinating personal tale of their relationship as well, which I tried to bring out in the book.
Brilliant. Before we wrap up, just thought, obviously, as we spoke about at the very start, obviously a theme running through the book is obviously how, in a nutshell, we weren't liked in the period. So yeah. How do you think we're perceived now? Question for both of you.
In relation to there or just generally?
I think that Everton are one of, maybe I'm like deluding myself here, but I genuinely believe that, you know, so we are like a lot of people's, you know, favourite second club, you know, so quite popular because we're unthreatening, because we're a side that aspires to be, you know, sort of up in the top six, but isn't quite capable of doing it. And, you know, everyone likes, like, you know, the plucky underachiever, if you like, which we were under David Moyes. Maybe that's, like, evolved a little bit since Farhad Moshiri's come in, and maybe not quite as popular. But I think people quite like that little plucky underachiever that, you know, so it's trying to get up there and achieving, you know, sort of beyond their means. And you don't want to be that. You'd rather be disliked and successful, you know, so as they were in the 1960s. Maybe that's changing a little bit under Moshiri, maybe because we have got more money now and we are spending huge sums of money. We're going back to that 1960s thing now, where you get, you know, your Paul Merson's talking about us ruining the transfer market, and you get people mocking, you know, the amount of money we spent on certain players. Maybe it is evolving a little bit and going back towards that.
I've just wondered whether how much of, you know, spectacular fallout with Watford and you know, academy bands and things, you know. And I'm not saying that's a direct comparison, but in terms of just wondering how much of that has shaped.
Not on the naughty boy stuff, you know.
Yeah, I think
there's lots of things that happened there that still affect us today. I talk at some length at the end. There's like a wrap-up chapter at the end where I reflect on things, and I talk about how, unlike other clubs in the 60s, we didn't leave it sort of a legacy in terms of the culture of football. You know, we had like Liverpool and Shankly and the Kop and Leeds, Dirty Leeds, and Chelsea, you know, the King's Road, and, you know, Man United, you know, you mentioned it, Best Lord and Charlton and City, Malcolm Allison and, you know, Lee Summerby and Colin Bell. We didn't leave our mark within the culture of football. For reasons like that, I think we didn't get the press coverage that we deserved, you know. And I think, so constantly, when we look at the reflections on that decade, we appear to be on the outside looking in.
And but the reality was, we were in thick of it,
but we're on the outside looking in. And I think that's why Harry, there's lots of reasons why Harry's not told about, was a great manager, which to cover in there. And some of the reasons are actually pretty sensible. And I think that is still there now. That we still appear to be a little bit on the outside looking in. And maybe a little bit, I know we've changed, I've tried to change in the last couple of years. That some of that insularity in the 60s was certainly there, perhaps, since. And there's lots of things that happened at that time that massively affect us as a football club now. For the simple reason that Moores and Carter invented us. As we stand, you know, as today, the club, as we, you know, some of the ground changes and stuff like this.
New roofs.
Belfield, and then obviously we moved to Vinch Farm. All that came in the Catrick and Moores era. So they created the modern Everton, but they also created the modern football club as well. And that internal legacy for Everton is still there. But we never really left a wider one for the game as a whole.
I'll tell you what really jumped out at me in that, which I totally passed me by, is that the number of giants of English football who post-1970 fell from grace. I mean, Everton did, you know, spectacularly and took, you know, some time to, you know, so about 15 years to get things back up to the heights again. Man United, even more so, got relegated. Leeds United, okay, they got to a European Cup final in 75, but then, you know, sort of fell after that. Tottenham got relegated. Yeah. Wolves, you know, fell from grace.
Just relegated.
Liverpool was the only club, really, that managed to survive that and actually, you know, sort of build on it. I'd never really thought of it that way before. Yeah. And it was
Chelsea got relegated, Man City ended up getting relegated. That left only two clubs, us and Liverpool. And so there was a big opportunity for us to go forward, but we made the wrong managerial appointment in Bingham. Liverpool made the right managerial appointment, Paisley maybe accidentally. There's a sliding doors moment there where we could have had Bobby Robson as manager in 73 and Liverpool could have appointed Jackie Charlton in 74. And the whole history then of the next 10 years could have been completely different.
And, we
could have
and got, the rest maybe.
Yeah, because if you, if and only. It's not, I'm not denigrating Liverpool here because obviously that great team, certainly under Paisley. But one of the reasons they were really successful from 70 to 85 was the fact that their traditional big rivals, as half of them were playing in the second division in that time.
Well, you look at the teams that finished second.
Yeah, I say that in the book, yeah.
Watford, Southampton, Ipswich,
QPR.
Wow.
Notts Forest. They were all provincial teams. Some of them, most of them have been in the second division in the 60s, but they'd filled that gap to replace the traditional powerhouses of English football. And there was only, they made a couple of changes in the game in 83, one of them being that the home team kept all receipts where previously they gave it 20% to the away team. But you got the ludicrous position. Some teams could get make more from going away to Anfield and Old Trafford than what they would do from their home game, you know. And that restored some of the power financially to the bigger clubs. And then that would carry on with the Premier League. And it was only when Howard, Everton, and then it was George Graham under Arsenal, then Alex Ferguson, and then Leeds, and then the Premier League helped restore that natural balance that had been in the 60s. And I quote that fact that when City won the title in 2012, it was first title for 44 years. Nine clubs were in the top 10 in both seasons, the same nine clubs. So that just shows you how the Premier League has restored that natural power, you know, that the natural powerhouses of English football. Back to the top again. But there was that vacuum between 70 and 85 that Liverpool filled perfectly, you know. And they had a great team as well, but it was made easy for them. But if we'd have got our appointment right in 73, we could have easily won 2, 3, 4 league titles with, because we had the money still.
Was that 73? Was that the one where you'd actually shaken hands on a deal and he refused to come because a national newspaper carried the story, got the exclusive and said that, you know, it's Robson for
that was 77, wasn't
it? That was
a different time, wasn't it? Yeah, that was when he said on local radio, didn't he? Because he used to tell you Bobby Robson's the next ever manager. Yeah. And he was, yeah, so 77, 73... I don't think he wanted it. I think he used Everton quite, and Barcelona, I think, quite skillfully in terms of negotiating new contracts on the back of incest from Everton. But Bobby would have been a great manager for Everton at 73. He had that hunger and desire that Carrick had in 61. You know, we'd done a similar sort of apprenticeship like Carrick had done at Sheffield Wednesday at Ipswich.
Mm. He was visionary.
He would have been a tremendous manager for us. We ended up getting Billy Bingham.
Ipswich team he created played the kind of football that Evertonians believe they have a God-given right to see. Yeah. It was beautiful, a wonderful football team.
And with it, it would have been a perfect fit in 73. And it didn't happen, sadly. And we missed out. But yeah, Dave's right. I touch on that at the back. That we, as Everton fans, we say the 70s were awful. But actually, they were quite good compared to a lot of other clubs. Our problem was is the local rivals across the park were winning anything, you know. Well, that's maybe for another. Yeah. I never know. I might.
That's for the sequel.
That's for the sequel.
So go on, Gav, then tell the listeners how we can get a copy, where from, etc., etc.
You can buy it on there, but the Cubatana, the publishers, you can go to their website. Must say, he's done a fabulous job, as ever, with the Cubatana, the cover. Yeah. Really evocative cover. You can buy it on usual sites, Amazon, etc., on the internet, and from Waterstones Bookshop, where I'm doing a signing with Derek Temple on Saturday the 28th, and I talk about Derek.
Yeah.
Might be in the book, what a great, and albeit underrated player he was. Some nice stories about Derek, about the type of clubs that were interested in him as well. Yeah, underrated player, Derek. And so also usual sites.
And I was going to say, you are going to be out and about more. You mentioned that one at Waterstones.
There'll be a few more events between now and Christmas, I would imagine. Yeah.
Out of interest, how long did it take you to do it from start to finish?
8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I started in 2011. Not all of that time is doing all bits, but I started researching in 2011. The thing about that book, it's the research that's gone into it. Mm. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write it as an outsider, not as an Everton fan, but as an outsider looking in.
Using the evidence and
yeah,
facts.
Yeah. I didn't want to sort of bring being an Everton fan into it. If I was a supporter of another club, how would I write this book?
How many people do you think you've spoken to as part of that research?
I didn't speak to anybody. That was the other thing. Okay. Of course, there's going to be my view on things.
Right, okay.
This is my view. based on all my research, which had taken me to countless days in the British Library in London for a start, you know, where I discovered some great things, you know, some really interesting stuff, you know, and so there's a lot of, I wanted to do that, to really tell that two-touch story of the decade, you know, because we are a massively unreported club in terms of books.
So what's the next one then, Gav? You mentioned this.
You never know. There might be another one, you know, on the pipeline. But yeah, it's good. Yeah, there has to be. You know, there has to be. The 70s was just as interesting.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah.
Interesting. Well, we look forward to that. And hopefully not in 8 years, maybe a bit sooner.
No, yeah.
But for now, Gav Buckland, Money Can't Buy His Love, Everton in the 1960s is out, available. And we highly, fully recommend you pick up a copy. So I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of the Royal Blue Podcast with myself, Dave Prentice, in conversation with Gavin Buckland. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.